podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket on this bank holiday Monday. I've been on a cycle round southwest London today, actually seen lots of club matches in progress. And today's show, we're going to focus on the amateur game for a bit, actually. Not least because of a story that reaches my inbox, which is of a 70-year-old called Bomber Smith taking 9 for 21 in his club's first league game of the season. It's Stafford Place CC against Danby in the North York Moors in the Langbaugh League. And he took 9 for 21, was second top wicket taker or best analysis in the country that particular weekend, the weekend before last. And it's an extraordinary story by a 70-year-old man who took 9 for 21. So I'm going to try and get him on, Bomber Smith, before this month is out. So an incredible story. And as I say, today we're going to focus a little bit on the amateur game with someone who is absolutely steeped in club and village cricket. So our special guest today is someone who I've never seen playing, but I've seen his brother playing. And I know about this family's obsession with cricket. It's the Holland family. And I know Tom. But of course, today our guest is James Holland, who is a novelist and a historian, a documentary maker, a podcaster. Your podcast with Al Murray, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, is an extraordinary success and an absolute must listen. James, thanks for coming on. I know that you're bursting to tell us about your recent success in the Cricketer Village Cup. So tell us about it.
Well, yeah, no, it was one of those sort of great days because we'd had a friendly match on Saturday, a sort of pre-season friendly on Saturday, where we'd got a bit walloped, if we're completely honest. And so Sunday was a big game and we were playing Burbage and Easton, who are in the Wiltshire and Gloucester Premier League. And on paper, should have also whipped us. So we were quite nervous. We did have a good team out.
By the way, who's we?
Oh, we is, sorry, Chalk Valley Cricket Club, to whom I'm extremely wedded. I'm very proud to be the club chairman. But it's been a roller coaster journey with that club, I can tell you. But anyway, we managed to skittle them all out for 148. Very low scoring game on our ground, which traditionally produces a lot more runs than that. We managed to see it home with nine balls left. So
a great victory. Were you in at the end, or did you take wickets, or what?
I opened up actually, and I'd a bit worried because the day before I just couldn't buy a run. I'd opened up the day before, and I could block it all right, but I couldn't get any runs away, and eventually I got out, and that was all a bit humiliating. So I went home on Saturday night feeling a bit depressed, to be perfectly honest, because you know I'm over 50 now, Simon, and I'm very much a kind of, you know, one of the older players in the club, and I kind of sort of feel the weight of pressure to kind of, you know, perform every year. And my big thing is I've got to get a 50 in the kind of first handful of games, or else I'm losing my skills too much. And every year for the last sort of, you know, however long, I've always managed it. But on Saturday night, I was thinking, God, am I ever going to get that magic 50 ever again? And then on Sunday, I didn't get 50, but I opened up and we had a good opening partnership. And I think we got to kind of, you know, 40 odd for no loss. And suddenly I was just seeing the ball all right. Then I did get an absolute belter. I got a leg stump Yorker, and I'm afraid that did skittle me. But we were well on the way, and I felt everyone in the team contributed that day. You know, everyone who bowled took a wicket. The catches were taken. I think the highest score was 27 in our side, which is kind of, you know, it's feeble really. But I think all the top six got a 20 or a 19 or a 25 or something like that. So it felt like a very complete team performance.
So you're in the next round then of the Cricketer Cup, the Cricketer Cup. Who are you playing and where are you playing? And maybe I can come and analyse the game.
Oh, God, I'd absolutely love you to. Sadly, I'm going to miss it because I'm away on that Sunday. It's Sunday, the 8th of May. The guys would absolutely love you to come down. It's Shrewton away, and they're a bit of a sort of old enemy, to be perfectly honest. Again, that's going to be a very, very tough fixture. So we're going to have our absolute gun players out. But Chalk Valley, it's interesting. I've been involved with Chalk Valley Cricket Club. I was brought up around here, and then I went away to London like a lot of people. And when I came back, the club was in dire straits. There was only sort of six friendly games a year, and it really needed sort of picking up by the scruff of the neck. And there was a few of us who kind of sort of did that. And actually, our old ground was played at what's really a kind of sort of a recreational ground. So it was sharing with football and tennis and a skate park. And there was a kind of big sports centre where they did sort of table tennis, and indoor bowls and all that kind of stuff. And it was just getting sort of, the outfield was being eaten away. And actually, bats are getting bigger and more sixes and stuff. It just wasn't quite big enough. And it wasn't attractive enough. And I kind of felt, if you've got a ground that's really, really beautiful, you'll always have players because you spend, it's not like a football match or a rugger match where you've got your 90 minutes or your 80 minutes and it's kind of winter and you don't really care what the aesthetics are like. You know, with cricket, particularly club cricket, amateur club cricket, you're out in that field a long time and you're either fielding for a long time or you're sitting in the pavilion kind of waiting to bat or having done your bat or whatever. So I think the aesthetics of cricket are kind of more important than they are for a lot of sports. And I remember just thinking, let's try and get another ground. And we were Chalk Valley. So Chalk Valley encompasses five villages. So it didn't have to be Broadchalk, which is where I live. And so we started sort of, once the seed had sort of been dropped, it started to kind of sprout and there was sort of no going back really. So we eventually found this beautiful spot in Bowerchalk, which is the next village up the road. You can't see a road from it. You've got church and a few village houses on one side. You've got this beautiful chalk downland on the other side. It's absolutely gorgeous. We were so lucky. And the lady who owned that particular field, it was part of a family's farm, but she personally owned that specific field, although she let it to the farm, let the farm use it, obviously. And she said, well, I'd love you to do this. She said, my condition is it can only be for cricket and cricket only. I don't want to find playing grounds or football pitches or whatever. And I went, no, that's absolutely fine. No problem at all. And so she leased it to us for 99 peppercorns with one peppercorn a year. And we raised all the money for it through public subscription. And we actually kind of, did it properly. We dug out the square. We got in some K-loam, sort of £14,000 worth of loam came in and was sort of properly graded and everything. It was really, really exciting. And on the 27th of June 2010, which was coincidentally my 40th birthday, we had the inaugural match against David English's Bunburys. And Graham Hick was there and Peter Drago and Alex Wakeley from Northants. And it was an amazing day. The sun shone and Jeff Thompson and Rob Bransgrove turned up to watch. And we had this incredible game. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, the cricketing gods were smiling on us. And we haven't really looked back. But a key part of what we were doing with that new ground was to build the junior section. And that's always been absolutely at the bottom of it. Have the beautiful ground, but also have the junior section. And I think generally speaking, clubs that don't have a junior section, I think their shelf life is probably quite limited, to be perfectly honest.
I can see that. It's a lovely part of the world because actually I've attended the Chalk Valley History Festival.
Yes, you have. Yeah, well,
hosted by Lord Marland, isn't it? Jonathan Marland, or at least.
Well, no. He's a patron. So right. We used to kind of sort of butter up Jonathan and say, yeah, can you get us? Can you get Simon down for us? And can you get David Gower down for us? I think you came with David Gower once, didn't you? So Jonathan was the kind of orchestrator. He's not actually directly involved in it, but he was.
It's a lovely.
Spot, he's a neighbour.
Oh, it's a gorgeous spot. So your club. I mean, you're chairman of this club. Yeah. What does a chairman worry about every day.
I worry about the future. I worry about funds. I worry about, you know, so we've risen up the, I think about 6 years ago, we decided that actually we did need to be in a league. So we joined the Dorset League, right? Because we're in southwest corner of Wiltshire. We're sort of 10 miles southwest of Salisbury. So we're right at the bottom of Wiltshire. It's actually very hard getting to those North Wiltshire clubs. You know, you're on those winding roads up to sort of Pusey and Marlborough and Chippenham and stuff.
It takes behind a tractor at every.
Yeah. And it takes forever. Whereas actually going down towards sort of Dorchester and those sort of places in Dorset is kind of a much easier and more pleasant drive. So we joined the Dorset League and we went in a kind of Division Five, and we've slowly grown up the divisions, and everyone's very ambitious for it. And we went from we were third division champions last year. We also won the entire Dorset T20 Cup and then got quite a long way in the regional T20 Cup and were beaten by the people that eventually won it. So that was no disgrace. But we're starting in Division Two. And the worry is that you kind of you just slightly overreach. And then, you know, you lose a couple of gun players and then suddenly you're losing a whole season, you know, suddenly before you know where you're back in Division Four and people are leaving and all that. So, you know, I'm not really worried about that, but you're constantly, again, just not being complacent. You know, you've got to just sort of keep on your toes. You know, running an amateur club is really tough, actually. It's great fun, but it involves a lot of people. And I think the other key thing about an amateur club is you've got to spread the load. You cannot have one or two people doing everything.
So what do you do? I mean, are you the person who takes the tee, or are you the person who rolls the pitch, or what kind of bit do you like doing?
Well, what I like doing is just sort of, you know, I've sort of become sort of slightly avuncular, I think. Well, no, I haven't. I don't think I'm taken seriously enough for that. But I think it's sort of steering it, really. I think chairman is about steering. It's about making sure that all the different levels are kind of working okay. So we've got a head coach, we've got a league captain, we've got a Sunday captain, we've got
how many members?
It's probably about 75, because it's about 30 adult players and 45 juniors, something like that.
Very good.
You know, so it's good. And you know, we've got the honorary secretary, we've got the honorary treasurer, and then we've got sort of committee members without portfolio, as I call it. And this is trying to give the kind of older, you know, the more responsible players a bit of ownership, a bit of, you know, that their voice is being heard, that they've got an opinion, that we respect that, that we want them to kind of respond to that. And trying to remind people that they shouldn't take any of this for granted, that they're incredibly lucky that they play on a beautiful, beautiful ground with an amazing pitch, proper laid square and all the rest of it, with great facilities, and just, you don't want to ram it down people's throats in any stretch of the imagination, but just sort of gently reminding people occasionally that they're lucky, and that comes with a certain responsibility. You know, you've all got, you know, a shared responsibility. Everyone's got to kind of help.
It's okay getting players and getting teams out, is it? Because I often worry about village cricket and their ability to field, you know, 11s on daily basis or a weekend basis.
Yeah, we've got enough, to be honest. We've got enough. Although, having said that, on the 21st of May, we're playing Shillingstone away, and it's an absolute catastrophe because our league captain and two of the other guys are away at a wedding because they're 30 and they're kind of just at that age. I've got a prior commitment up in Yorkshire, which is sort of postponed twice because of COVID, which I can't get out of. So we're down to about four players as it stands at the moment. And Shillingstone are, you know, potentially top of, you know, one of the better teams in Division Two of the Dorset League. So we're kind
if anyone's listening to this, I suppose.
Yeah, come and join Chalk Valley. I'd hugely welcome that. And we are very, very open to new players. We always like to see new players. And again, it's a mixture. You want the teenagers, you want the 30-year-olds, but you need a couple of kind of, you know, middle-aged people whose kids are a bit older who are kind of beyond that stage where, you know, the wives are going to get annoyed about you going out every Saturday. So, you know, and I think we've got that kind of, we've got that balance, and we've got great facilities. We've got a bowling machine. I tell you what we've got at the moment, Simon, it's absolutely fantastic, which our head coach, Glenn, who's just an absolute legend in the club, young guy, but all the juniors just love him. He's this sort of huge, great, beefy guy with a big beard. He bought us a self-loading machine for the bowler. And it's just an absolute joy because, you know, because I work for myself, you know, if it's a beautiful morning, you know, I can get up at the ground at 8 a.m., set it all up. It feeds you about 28 deliveries with 12-second intervals. You know, you've got 5 minutes to collect the balls up, think about your game. You've got another 28. Before you know where you are, you've got that kind of 130 balls by kind of 9 o'clock. It's just fantastic. 65 mile an hour, half volleys. What's not to like? I mean, it's just brilliant.
It sounds great. And by the way, I'd love to know what you're feeling about the state of village cricket is. I had a bit of a sample of it last summer myself. I went on a tour of the North York Moors with the Millfields Cricket Club, who are a wandering cricket club in southwest London. And we played a number of games. I was hit in one village. It was in the depths of the North York Moors, a stunning valley. I was hit for the biggest six I've ever been hit for in my career. I mean, I admit I was only bowling at kind of 23 miles an hour, but this ball went so far that it took us 10 minutes to find it. It went over two fields and a road and ended up right in the middle of some kind of cow pat somewhere. Essence of cow pat for the next delivery kind of thing. But actually, the standard of North York Moors village cricket was pretty good. What are you seeing in your area for sort of standards?
Yeah, it varies a bit. I mean, it was interesting when we were doing the T20 Cup last year because we had to beat the top three teams in the Dorset Premier League to win. So inevitably, yeah, amongst them, they've got some pretty good players. And we came up against someone who played Somerset Twos. We came up against someone who played county cricket for Dorset for a number of years, and you know, it was sort of a bit long in the tooth, and so I ended up playing for Dorchester instead. You know, and there were some very good players on display. The final, it was interesting because the guy who was playing for Sherborne, who had played Somerset second 11, apparently, you could tell he was just a class above anyone else on the pitch. But he did a really stupid thing. You could see I was at short third man. And he obviously thought, oh, he's an older guy. He's going to be a bit rubbish. So he tried to reverse sweep, missed completely, got bowled for kind of 25, just as they were threatening our total. So it was, he threw his wicket away. But yeah, you do see some quite good cricket. And I've got to say, I really like that. I love playing on better pitches and better grounds. And, you know, the better the bowling, bring it on. Apart from last Saturday when I just couldn't get it off the square for whatever reason. You know, I think it's good, and I think one of the great things about cricket is you can always tinker with your game, and you know, you can always try and look to improve and tinker with the technique. I've done a little bit of work on my setup this season, you know, just at the start. You know,
trigger working movement.
I practiced the trigger movement actually, and I've taken it out again because I don't think the bowling I come up against is kind of fast enough quite to warrant it. I mean, you get people who are bowling sort of, you know, maybe 70. But you don't get 80 miles an hour. And I just find just keeping my head still is better because of the trigger. I started to find my head was sort of falling back a bit. What I have done is I've just adjusted my grip a little bit. I used to be very, very top of the handle. I've just moved it down a little bit. And actually that has given my top hand just a bit more control, I think. I was worried that my bottom hand was coming in. But you know, I mean, all this kind of tweaking technical stuff. I just find it endlessly fascinating that here I am at 51 and I can still hone, there's still things I can do. You know, the build up to the season and everything, I just get so excited. I mean, I'm very, very interested in the Second World War, don't get me wrong. And, you know, it's a passion as well as a job, I suppose. It's not really a job, but you know what I mean? It's a means of a source of writing books and making all these documentaries and podcasts and everything. But cricket, I am completely obsessed with.
So I can see behind you there a lot of history books, presumably they're history books. What about cricket books and what about cricket history? Have you ever got interested in that?
Yeah, well, one of my proudest professional moments was giving a lecture to the MCC in the long room about cricket and the Second World War. And I focused on Keith Miller, the legendary Australian all-rounder, and Hedley Verity, the, you know, one of the greatest bowlers that England's ever produced. And it was a great honour, obviously, to be there. But what made it even more special was beside me on a plinth was Hedley Verity's England cap And Keith Miller's 48 Invincibles tour cap. And that was, you know, there's that, you can't beat that kind of tactile link, can you? You're touching the thing that has adorned the head of one of your heroes. It's a very, very special moment. So that was great. So I've done a bit of work on Hedy Verity, and actually I've been out to, I've worked out exactly where it is that he was mortally wounded. He was killed in the Catania plain in Sicily, making an attack across some very, very difficult terrain. I mean, Sicily is a brutal place in which to fight because it's obviously very hilly and mountainous. The only kind of flat bits are not flat at all. There's little undulations and little dikes and little water features and stuff which get in the way. And he was leading his company, B Company, the First Green Howards, and they were doing so much better than the companies either side of them that they basically got slightly ahead of themselves. It was a night attack. There was a cornfield that was on fire, so they were being silhouetted. He was trying to get his men to go forward, made himself a very, a clear target. He got hit by a mortar fragment in the shoulder, in his left-hand shoulder. And unfortunately, he was picked up by the Germans and not by the British. Had he been picked up by the British, there's a very good chance, I think, he would have survived because we have penicillin now and all the rest of it. And actually, what did for him was probably blood poisoning, a chronic hemorrhage as a result of ulceration and sepsis. You know, I mean, a terrible, terrible death. I mean, he would have been in absolute agony for the 10 days it took him. And, you know, first of all, he was taken to a medical center by the Germans, which was under shell fire. Germans just had really poor medication by that point, no anesthetics or anything like that. Then he was put on a truck, taken to the Messina Straits, then across on a ferry, then onto a train, then taken to Caserta, where he subsequently died. And it's just a very, very upsetting thing because, of course, you know, one feels, you know, these people because they're so famous and because of what they did on the cricket field. And, you know, I've seen his words and heard what he's had to say about things, about cricket and all that. And he joined up out of absolute moral principle. You know, he really felt that Nazism was an evil that needed to be stopped. He thought about joining up in 1938 at the time of the Munich crisis. And actually the commander of the First Green Howards said, no, go away to South Africa on the cricket tour to South Africa, but read up on military matters over the years so that, you know, not completely new to you. And then, you know, should anything happen next year, you know, in the years to come, then we can sort of revisit it. And so on Friday, the 1st of September, he was playing in a charity benefit game down at Sussex at Hove, where I think he took six for kind of next to nothing. But, you know, they won the match. And then the Yorkshire team were on the coach on the Saturday back up to Yorkshire. War was declared on Sunday the 3rd, and he joined up on Monday the 4th. I mean, incredibly brave man, you know, and more than did his bit.
Wasn't his commander or one of the people in his group also mad about cricket?
Yes. So this was General Sir Miles Dempsey, who was the he was a corps commander. So it goes Army Group, which is a group of armies, then Army, then the next sort of unit under that is a corps, and then a division and brigade, etc. So he was the corps commander in Sicily of 13 Corps, and the First Green Howards were part of 13 Corps. And before they set sail for Sicily, they'd been in the canal zone in the Suez Canal in Egypt, and they'd played some matches, you know, on coconut matting in the desert. And Dempsey had come up against Hedy Verity in a game, and Hedy had given him a few dollies to kind of smack and then skittled him out, and they got chatting and everything. And Dempsey was a mad keen cricketer and, you know, was talking to a subordinate officer because he was only, you know, he was Captain Verity at that point, and he was a general, but was completely in awe of him, you know, as he would be. And anyway, the Sicilian campaign then happens, and Dempsey had made it clear that he was, after this attack across the Catania Plain, he was going to kind of purloin Hedy Verity and get him out of the front line and bring him into his own staff. The following year, Dempsey is Second Army Commander, which is the kind of principal British army, not only for D-Day, but all the way through Northwest Europe, all the way through to V-Day in May 1945. So had Verity survived that night attack, chances are he'd have ended up working on Dempsey's staff for the rest of the Sicilian campaign, but also for Normandy and D-Day and all the way through to the end of the war. And, you know, he'd have ended up a higher rank than he was when he died, and, you know, incredibly celebrated and all the rest of it. And it's, that's just, the way the cookie crumbles, you know, it's just very tragic. But it was interesting because I was able to go to the Battalion War Diary, the first Green Howards. They had a hand-drawn map of the whole of the plan of the attack and where things happened and which company was where and where the German defences were and all the rest of it. And using Google Earth, you could marry up the hand-drawn map with 1943 aerial photographs and Google Earth today, and work out exactly where it was that he was killed. And unfortunately, it's now a mafia-owned citrus plantation. So you can't get precisely to the spot where he would have died, but you can get within a couple of hundred yards, and you can certainly be there. And it's a very poignant thing. You stand on one of these little dikes, and you look there, and you're looking absolutely in the direction, and you think, 200 yards away, where I'm looking right now, Etna beyond, 200 yards away, that's where Hedley Verity was when he was struck. And his second in command of that battalion was killed literally a split second later. And you can go to the cemetery, and there's his second in command in that grave at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, you know, cemetery. And I've got to say, it is really, really moving. It really is. And I've always wanted to sort of go back with a spinner or a bowler. And
you want to go back to Jeff Boycott, actually, because he worshipped Hedley Verity's reputation and kind of legacy. And there's always, it always goes on about how wonderful a bowler he was from what he knows. I mean, Boycott is a great student of the history of the game, actually, and in fact, a great student of history generally. By the way, another person, another famous cricketer who was involved in the Second World War that I've talked to about this, obviously sadly died now, is Alec Bedser. And he and his brother were rescued. They were in somewhere like Normandy. And, you know, there was an air raid on where they were, an attack on where they were, and they were picked up by a truck kind of passing and kind of escaped.
But they had a lucky escape.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I was also lucky enough to interview Reg Simpson, who I think got a DFC, actually, a Distinguished Flying Cross. He was flying transport planes in Southeast Asia Command. So out in sort of, you know, over the Himalayas for the Chinese and in Burma and whatnot. And, you know, again, brave man. Didn't like Len Hutton.
Actually, my favourite story about the Second World War is actually, and cricket, is the story of a match going on, because there were a few cricket matches still played in England, weren't there, during the war? And one of them was at Lord's. And my old coach, my first coach, Jack Robertson, opening batsman for Middlesex in England, a fantastic man, actually, an incredibly dignified man and a very, very good coach, actually, as well. He was batting. I think R.E.S. Wyatt was running into bowl at Lord's during either 1943 or 1944. And suddenly a Zeppelin comes hovering over, and they see it sort of literally hovering over the ground and dive to the floor. The R.E.S. Wyatt, in the middle of his run-up, so throws himself to the floor. They all throw themselves to the floor. The doodlebug carries on over the ground. Luckily, the engine didn't cut out. And they hear it cut out over Regent's Park, and it detonates over Regent's Park in a big explosion. And then R.E.S. Wyatt, eventually, when clearly the coast is clear, R.E.S. Wyatt gets up and carries on his run-up and lets go of the ball. And apparently Jack Robertson pulled it for six.
How amazing. Well, I've got to say, if there's one innings I would have liked to have seen, it's Keith Miller's 185 he got in the fight. It was the victory test series.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was a kind of, I think there was a sort of England team against the rest of the world. And I think it was that one that he got, that one. He was going to clear the pavilion with one of his sixes, because he got six sixes in that innings, which, you know, with a bat set using in those days, it's just, you know, that's going some. And it hit a bit of shrapnel damage and bounced back the wrong way. Otherwise, it was projected to have cleared the roof. But by all accounts, that was an incredible innings. And of course, that's when he did his famous line. He was asked beforehand, saying, you know, Mr. Miller, you know, how are you feeling about the pressure of the next test match? And he said, pressure, I'll tell you what pressure is. Pressure is having a Messerschmitt up your arse, not playing cricket.
So he did actually say that, did he?
He did actually say that, yeah. And it's interesting, because when he was painted, there was an official portrait of him done, commissioned by the MCC, to hang in Lord's, obviously. when he sat for that portrait in whenever it was, 1992 or whatever, he chose to wear his Air Force tie, not his any cricketing tie. You know, and that's it meant a lot to him. And people have sort of questioned, you know, how much he did in the war and all the rest of it. But, you know, he absolutely stepped up. You know, he really did.
Listen, fascinating. Just show us your memorabilia to finish with. Your cricketing, you've got some good cricketing little mementos there.
Yes, no, I do. And obviously my cricketing is in front of me, so I can always look at it, which obviously means you then can't see it. So I've fished it out. This is perhaps my one of my most fabled possessions. This is a portrait of Viv Richards. He's actually, and then a series of him holding my cricket bat for a photo shoot. Back in a former life, Simon, I used to work for Penguin Books doing PR. And in 2000, Viv did his latest version of his autobiography. And it was my task to sort of take him around to book signings. And the West Indies were over that summer. And I had an amazing summer hanging out with Viv and getting all the all his anecdotes. And he was just the most brilliant. I mean, you must know him and have met him and stuff. His charisma really does fill a room. And people say that about certain people, but it really does with him. He was so charming and so fantastic and so on a completely different plane to everybody else and knew it. But somehow that wasn't arrogant with Viv. It was just Viv, you know, because he's this complete god. And he told me some great stories and things. So the one thing I do remember was talking about the late great Shane Warne, and I said to him, you know, was there any players from the modern age you would have liked to have played? He said, yeah, well, I would have liked to have played Shane Warne. And I said, well, how would you approach that? And he said, all bowlers field off their own bowling. They don't like, you know, if a ball comes so well, they'll always try and stop it. He said, so what I'd have done with Shane Warne is I'd have smacked the first few balls back at him, so I'd sort of bruise his fingers, and then I'd just take him to pieces. And he just said it as in a kind of, you know, there was absolutely no doubt about this whatsoever. There was no room for any question about it. This is how it would have been. And, you know, you couldn't really doubt him. But I've got a collection of cricket bats as well. And this is very treasured. This is a Slazenger that used to be owned by Ian Bell. And he scored 3 test hundreds with it in 2006. I've got a Spitfire because obviously, you know, I have to have that. Although sadly it's broken. I've got a new Neon, which is part owned by Ian Bell, and I haven't used it yet, but it's got a lovely feel to it. I mean, bats have changed so much, haven't they? That's why you're being slogged for the biggest six of your life in the Yorkshire Moors. You know, I think it's a combination, isn't it? It's a combination of T20 and people thinking, actually, no, I don't just have to kind of block it and tap it to extra cover. I can do this kind of baseball thing of putting my front leg out of the way and giving it a massive great swipe.
Have you tried the ramp shot yet?
No, I haven't, but a couple of guys in the team have, you know. I've never seen it being done successfully.
Get into the nets with your bowling machine and your automatic feeder, and set it to 70 miles an hour and have a go at the ramp shot, but just make sure you wear a mouth guard.
Yeah, my wife's been trying to persuade me to start wearing a lid. I've never worn a lid because, you know, I grew up in an age where you didn't. So I've been wearing one this season, but I just don't like it at all.
Oh, well, you're a brave man, but just hope you don't get one that leaps off a length and damages that fine face of yours. James, thank you very much for your time today anyway. And it's been fascinating to hear about your life in cricket, as well as history, and the amazing. There's so many stories about the Second World War and cricket, which we should pick up on another time.
No. But I've got to say, Simon, thank you for having me on. It's been an absolute honour because I'm a massive fan of the podcast. I think I've listened to every single episode. So to be actually on it is a massive treat. So thank you.
Well, I hope you found that contribution from James Holland, the historian, fascinating, especially the stuff about the Second World War and Hedley Verity. That was really interesting stuff. And to think that he actually went back to trace where he was injured in Italy is really quite intriguing, in fact. And James can be found as one half of the We Have Ways of Making You Talk podcast, which he shares with Al Murray, of course. They're on Tuesdays and Thursdays, to be found on all your usual podcast networks. So that's it for this week. Also, just to say, we have a special guest in the Virtual Cricket Club on Tuesday night, the 4th of May, 7 p.m. It's Bumble, David Bumble Lloyd, the legend of the commentary box, the umpiring position, and of course the cricket field. Also England manager back in the 1990s too. So he's done everything in the game. He's a fascinating and hilarious character. You can join us and ask him a direct question if you join the World's Best Cricket Club at worldsbestcricketclub.com. It's Bumble on Tuesday night, the 4th of May. It'll be a fascinating and hilarious evening. So hope you can join us for that. In aid, of course, of the Cricketers Trust, the Professional Cricketers Trust. As I say, that's it for the podcast for today. And hope you can join us again for the next one. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.